Welcome to the Critical Few Actions to Improve Your Business podcast. I'm John Downes, and I'm here to help you cut through the overwhelm and prioritize what matters most to improve your business. Let's get started and discover the critical few actions that have the biggest impact. Today, I'd like to introduce you to Rachel Delaney, who I've known since 2010 and has helped a number of my successful CEOs with their business legal issues. If you're leading a business and worrying about securing your IP for future sale, or protecting yourself with trading partners, or knowing your employer obligations and building an exit-ready business from day one, then this is a conversation to listen to. Rachel, welcome.
Thanks, John. It's great to be here.
So Rachel, today we're going to talk about how and when medium business founders and CEOs should get legal support to help build and protect their business and prepare it for eventual exit. Most of them think that engaging a lawyer is a last resort activity. But over the years, I've seen that in this overregulated and increasingly litigious environment, the enormous value of being able to tap into legal support early on an as-needs basis rather than as a last resort. But first, tell me about your legal eagle journey. How did you first get interested in law and how did that journey evolve?
Yeah, thanks, John. I've had quite a winding career in the law. I started as an article clerk in one of the biggest law firms in the country. But then I went to work for a boutique firm. And then I went to work in-house, working within a large organization. But that was where I really loved to be, being close to the business and understanding that legal advice is just one of many moving factors. And the legal advice is really just generally a means to an end. Let's face it, nobody really loves paying for legal advice unless they need it. But working within companies for over a dozen years, after doing that, I wanted to set up my own business on my own terms, but with the same kind of ethos of acting like a business person rather than an external lawyer. So that led me to explore the concept of a fractional general counsel model, which allows businesses to access high-level legal expertise without the overhead of a full-time hire. And it helps me to help be embedded in a strategic partner to the business.
Yeah, working client side. I know that most publicly listed businesses have their own legal counsel and in-house legal teams. So they clearly see it as being essential. But when we spoke the other day, you intrigued me when you mentioned that even startups are getting in-house counsel these days. I used to think that's simply unaffordable and probably overkill for medium businesses.
Yeah, I think it's particularly true in the technology space. There are a lot of risks that are complex. Startup businesses in that technology space have concerns like privacy and data security. But then there's also the speed factor. Startups are looking for that speed of contracting to turn contract drafts around and negotiate quickly. They just simply can't wait that 1 or 2 weeks to turn around a commercial contract draft that you would get if you were working externally with a law firm. So with fractional roles, it can be much more affordable. Because, you know, with traditional law firms, they're often still charging on that hourly basis and that can be cost prohibitive. So you can have a fractional general counsel, which allows that flexibility and a cost-effective alternative. So you can have a dedicated legal expert who understands your business and all of its various drivers and quirks, but you have them only for the hours that you need them. And that's really appealing for startups and medium-sized businesses so that they can build a strong legal foundation and address key business risks before they become major issues, but all within a reasonable budget.
Okay, so let's unpack that. I know that at every stage of business growth, from idea and startup through to medium business exit, that there's a plethora of issues that need to be addressed, nipped in the bud, or handled with gusto, but usually legal support's brought in at the last minute. So walk me through a case as to how this might unpack.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you're running a business and you've got all the critical functions crying out for funding, legal's not necessarily considered high on the priority list, but it does really pay dividends to address legal issues early if you can. So for instance, I recall I had this fantastic startup client. They were developing software that was really innovative in their industry, but like many startups, they were moving so fast along that path that they hadn't really properly considered their intellectual property ownership and consolidating that. Their main contributors for the development of IP in their initial minimum viable product or their sort of early stage prototype, they had a former founder who had since moved on from the business and some externally contracted software developers. So in relation to the former founder, they had assumed that his contribution was tipped into the business when they incorporated. And as for the external developers, they had assumed that because they had paid for the work that they owned the intellectual property. So in either case, that wasn't actually what had happened. Mm-hmm. And they hadn't secured the clear intellectual property assignments in writing from either that former founder or from the developers.
Oh, no.
And this turned into a huge problem. So when they started talking to potential investors for a capital raise, investors rightly raised this as a major red flag because the unclear intellectual property ownership would completely derail a funding round or devalue what they had considered the business to be worth. So fortunately, in this case, the former founder was able to be reasoned with and incentivized to sign an assignment. And in respect to the external developers, I worked with each contractor to get those necessary assignments in place in order to rectify the issue. But having to reverse engineer that process after the fact is a lot more difficult than having the contracts in place, ensuring that had been addressed at the time. In the case of the former founder, at the time of incorporation, everybody who had contributed prior to incorporating the business should be assigning their IP into the business. Or at the contract stage, if you're engaging developers, having an appropriate contract that actually has an IP assignment in it and not assuming that just happens because you've paid money for the service.
That's the big issue with contractors, that the IP rests with them unless it's declared as otherwise in the contract at starting point. And intellectual property ownership is one of the most important things that a venture capitalist or even private equity is going to ask is in the due diligence phase is, do you actually own what your business is based on?
Exactly, particularly in that software space.
Yeah, yeah. And when we think about startups, there's a whole raft of other issues that they need to be addressing really from day one as well.
Like, yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's there's all sorts of issues that need to be considered as well as intellectual property ownership. There's employment contracts, there's employee share plans that you might need to set up and dealt with appropriately in Australia to take advantage of, you know, potential tax incentives and the like. So making sure that those are set up appropriately is really important. And the commercial contracting is another big one. Obviously, revenue is what drives the startup's growth, and they need to be able to turn around commercial contracts quickly. And so I've worked with a lot of startups to develop contract playbooks to sort of help the sales teams know what is and isn't negotiable and sort of give guardrails so that they're empowered to actually negotiate contracts and escalate issues that require legal input more on an efficient basis. I guess the alternative is to have a legal person review every contract. But if you're a startup who has to pick and choose which ones to escalate, having a contract playbook is a good way to know where those kind of red flag risks are and make sure that those are escalated while not slowing down commercial deals unnecessarily.
Yeah. So, Rachel, when we look at this contract playbook, what does that sort of look and feel like?
So a contract playbook might take many forms. It might be a table or some kind of resource that is readily available to people in the business, say you're a SaaS provider, that might step out a term of what your standard contract clause says, what that ultimately means, what a client might come back and take issue with, what is an acceptable response, is it flexible or is it not flexible? And if we are willing to negotiate on that particular term, who does that need to be escalated to in order to approve that risk? So an example would be a limitation of liability and having a cap on liability. The SaaS provider will start with a modest liability cap in their contract, and their client might push back and want something that is anything from unlimited for everything to 10 times the contract value or anything in between. And so it will sort of step out to anyone in the business to know, okay, well, if the client wants 10 times liability cap, that needs to be approved by this person. And so it gives them a clear pathway forward. If it's, we never can agree to change this for whatever reason, it gives you a justification that you can go back to the client and say, I'm sorry, we are not able to change this clause for XYZ reason. And it gives them a bit of a talking point as to what that reason is, rather than just saying no. And so that gives people a bit more confidence to speak to the contract without necessarily having to always have legal doing the negotiating. So it sort of empowers people within the business to to deal with the negotiations, and then only once they stray outside of what's in the contract playbook might they need to be escalated to the legal person to sort of take over.
Yeah, look, that'd be a huge value add from the perspective of not just enabling better informed conversations and escalating risk to the right levels of decision maker, but frankly, actually just getting these things on the table so that salespeople are even aware, because quite often they're, as they should be, enthusiastically chasing the sale and aiming to close, that things like the contractuals often can be overlooked with the excitement of getting the deal. And that is a recipe for disaster, particularly if these contractual issues don't even get brought up in the first place. And people just send off an invoice and pray for payment, not pray for that they won't end up need to look at the contract that they've actually inadvertently signed. I guess, speaking of inadvertent things, that then also brings the case with, doesn't matter whether it's a startup or whether it's a 25-year mature business, wage theft. There's been a lot in the papers over the last couple of years about wage theft, which is a pretty inflammatory term. But the simple reality is there are issues around employee payments and whether or not they've been made well. How does that sort of come up in your field of view?
Yes, I mean, I've definitely followed with interest how the sort of regulatory landscape in this area is changing, and the penalties and the laws around wage theft had increased dramatically in the past sort of 12 to 18 months. And it can be quite daunting for employers in a business to really know where to start to check that their payroll processes are actually paying people appropriately. There are personal and in some cases criminal responsibilities that might fall on an employer for wage theft. So it is really an important issue to get right. And so it can help to sort of help finance teams and people teams to understand the classification of employee, you know, when they're a member of an award or whether they are at the correct level of experience in that award. And making sure that the superannuation payments have been appropriately paid and that their payroll processes reflect what it is that is their proper sort of salary and remuneration information, and do a bit of an audit, because being proactive on this can really lessen the impact of any potential penalty if good faith steps are being made to actually try and make sure that this is right. But if you have a lot of employees, that can be a hugely daunting task.
Yeah. And it's typically inadvertent as opposed to overt. People make genuine errors, or they don't realise that things have changed with the award and the implications that has. You know, I've got a colleague who works in the payroll space, and so you would suggest pretty adept in this space. But I do remember her telling me that, you know, she'd spent 4 weekends re-reconciling her payroll and was absolutely mortified at the fact that, you know, she'd made a $2.46 error, which hadn't been reconciled properly, and found that she'd underpaid one of her employees for 14 months to the tune of $2.46 per month. We're not talking sheep stations here. But as a payroll professional, she was pretty horrified by that as an oversight. And so, you know, if she can do it and she's a very diligent person, then the average koala bear is probably a tad exposed at some point anyway, because we are all human. When you've been operating in business for a number of years, you often forget how much contractual work actually exists. There's contracts with your suppliers, and the question is, okay, are these reasonable contracts with suppliers that actually are on decent trading terms that we're prepared to accept? Then on the flip side, we've got contracts with our customers, which might be end users or end customers, but then there's contracts with potentially licensees or distributors, and they're very different animals yet again. They're a much more sophisticated buyer, but they're also buying something fundamentally different. Is it access to IP? Is it access to the brand? Who's handling the trading margins? Who's handling any warranty claims? All of those things. For a startup, that's quite an involved process. And often completely overlooked because, you know, you've always got your legal counsel and Mr. Google with his substantial professional indemnity insurance of $0, which you can rely on. And of course, the other one who's really good is the kitchen table lawyer who drove you to work this morning. So neither of those, I think, are particularly reliable. They might provide some interesting opinion, but that's about it. So for a startup, that's quite a mouthful of activities, let alone the employee contracts, ESOP contracts, all of that is really quite involved. And then, of course, if you're going through a capital raise, then the question becomes one of how much for how much and what are the constraints, what are the kickers, and how much will we be left with after round, not just round one, but round two, three, four, and five?
Yeah, precisely.
And I would say that all startups completely ill-equipped to do that unless they start from a commercial legal background in themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I really enjoy working in the field of startups because the people who are generally starting startups are passionate about a particular, you know, solving a particular problem in the world. And they often come at it from being someone who's been frustrated by that problem. So, you know, in my client base, the people who I'm servicing are very experienced and smart people in their various fields, coming from health or education or medicine.
Deep subject matter expertise,
but yeah, very unfamiliar with some of the commercial contracting nuances. So that's been really helpful from my perspective to be able to partner with them and provide that commercial expertise.
Yeah, one of the things that startups have in common is things like appetites for pizza and two-minute noodles, because they're actually bootstrapping these things themselves until they can find a funding partner. How does the fractional legal counsel work in such a way that it actually helps them when they're very cash flow poor?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, a fractional counsel opportunity can work well for startups because we can agree on a retainer basis to a set number of hours each month or days per week, which is far more affordable than, you know, actually having to hire someone on a full-time or even a part-time basis with all the overheads that are involved with that, or engaging a traditional law firm where you're paying in 6-minute increments for every single task that they do. Fractional is a nice sort of bridge between those things, and you can have access to a person who knows your business and understands your technology and what your strategic goals are. So that way, when a contract needs review or advice is needed, I can help knowing the not just specifics of that particular deal, but knowing the whole commercial context of the company. And that's in my head already. That helps me to be a lot more targeted in my advice rather than just taking the traditional legal approach, which is to flag every single risk, particularly because startups just have more risk tolerance than other businesses. And
they have to by nature.
That's right. And they don't want to slow down deals on trivial things that don't matter.
Yeah. Yeah. And does that also provide the opportunity for in-house counsel to actually participate in, from an equity perspective or equity conversion opportunities? Or is there a conflict of interest that's part of that issue? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I haven't gone down that path myself at the moment. I do know some fractional counsel that do on that basis. I think it can be managed, but it does present on the face of it a conflict of interest that does need to be properly managed. But yeah, that is an opportunity that I know that some fractional counsel take in order to sort of service businesses that don't have the cash in front.
Yeah, yeah. And that's really interesting. Most of my clients, I guess, are at the other end of the scale. They've built up a successful business and they're either looking to 2 or 10 exit, or they're looking to exit from it, you know, like so many 60-plus-year-olds who've got healthy businesses. How does that fractional counsel process come into play?
It's a nice problem to have if you're, you know, if you've got a healthy business and you're looking to hang up your boots. But yeah, whether you're a startup or you're an experienced business looking to expand or sell your business, it can be long-term, but it is temporary by nature. So if you are, you know, entering a phase of growth or a large strategic project, it is a good opportunity to bring a fractional counsel on board from an early stage in a cost-effective way to advise on the deal as it's happening. So this isn't specifically about business exit, but I had a client who was a well-established business and was looking for growth. And they had historically provided small and medium-sized businesses with their technology. But they were starting to get interest from enterprise-sized customers, which of course brings big revenue and growth opportunities. But dealing with enterprise customers is a whole different ballgame when you come to contract negotiation, as I should know, because I worked on the enterprise side of the desk for years. So the business was sort of facing a bit of a shell shock when it came to dealing with enterprise and their some processes and their contractual negotiation and dealing with their procurement teams, and needed some assistance to help navigate that process. So that was a client that I was able to help on a fractional basis. So going through their procurement processes, there's a significant imbalance of bargaining power when dealing with a large enterprise.
That's an understatement.
They're pushing their own standard contracts, even if they're maybe unfit for what the purpose is that you're using it for. They might often have unlimited liability clauses and onerous data security obligations that at that time my client wasn't fully confident to handle. Mm-hmm. So they didn't want to lose that potential lucrative client, but they needed a bit of help knowing what was negotiable and what was probably going to be wasting their time in terms of spending their currency wisely in terms of the issues that you want to, what you want to raise. So they were stuck. They didn't have an in-house person to negotiate these agreements and understand the nuances of what was required of them. So yeah, so as we sort of talked about before with contract playbook, I helped them with this client, but also to develop a contracting playbook, which helped give their sales teams guidance on what are the acceptable terms, what are the fallback positions if those aren't successful, what are the risks that need to be escalated, and where are things that you just actually need to really just push back on. And then there's also grueling sort of security clearance processes and internal compliance processes, which can be a nasty surprise if you're not used to dealing with an enterprise. So yeah, I helped this particular client navigate those challenges, and they were able to move into this enterprise space, which unlocked a lot of growth for their business.
Yeah. Well, for the uninitiated, dealing with the top end of town and dealing with government just brings a whole layers of complexity and compliance obligations that you're blissfully unaware of if you're operating warily with the middle market or with consumers who are nowhere near as sophisticated. But to be fair, those governance requirements of large corporate and government are there to protect both the shareholders, their reputation, and the taxpayer in the case of government. So it's not unreasonable. But, you know, certainly my experience over a lot of years has been that quite often you get served up a contract that you're pretty well told that you can read it as much as you like, but you're either signing it or there's no deal. It may not be fit for purpose, as you described. I remember being given doing a professional services contract with a large organization and told that this was their standard construction contract, which was great, except for the fact that I was offering them professional services, not a building. And so therefore some of those mandatory things were just actually not mandatory at all. And knowing what you can negotiate and what you can't negotiate is a real game changer, because there are things that just don't really matter as much, but because it's written down, it's got to be addressed. And you can unwittingly expose yourself to liability and consequence if you are not adept at reading or looking behind what's actually sitting in that contract. So it's an absolutely essential process, particularly for the unwitting. That's a common side of things when we're looking at a growth phase. But I've now actually, at the moment, Rachel, I've got three clients that are looking at business combinations or divestments. And so what do you see as being the big issues in preparation for an exit or for a merger?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're looking at an exit or a merger, the big issues often revolve around having an M&A-ready business, ideally from day one, or at least trying to get the house in order ahead of a client coming or a potential investor or purchaser coming knocking. So I worked with a client that was looking to sell their business. And while business was profitable, their internal records were a bit of a mess. So for example, the evidence of their asset ownership, so remember that IP problem that we were talking about earlier? Yeah. That information and evidence was scattered. Their client contracts were inconsistent or missing, and there were some lingering shareholder issues that had arisen a couple of years ago, but maybe gone dormant. Never been properly put to bed, exactly. And they were quite overwhelmed with where to start in terms of sorting it out. They knew that any investor or purchaser that was coming to do due diligence would uncover all of these issues, which would either delay or potentially derail the deal. So I came in when they were considering that sale process and helped them tidy up their documentation. So that really helped in terms of being involved early. We could prepare a good-looking data room, identify the gaps, track some risks, and get it all in really good shape. And so this preparation just helped give an impression. I say that obviously they were, you know, a mature and organized business, but it helps support that impression for potential purchasers in the sense that everything was in order when you lift the curtain. So this helped them to close faster and at a much better price than they might have done if there was a big sort of mess to sort out.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, any buyer is going to be looking to de-risk the deal from as the starting point. They're not just looking to actually pay the least possible price because they can't price in that risk, but getting that stuff sorted out and then and therefore being able to actually present a data room that actually is comprehensive and robust makes for a much more credible discussion with the buyer.
That's right.
And how does a fractional work in that scenario? Again, I'm getting the impression that fractionals are largely project-based or phase of business-based as opposed to a long-term continuum.
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of the good thing about fractional is that you can flex them up and down as needed based on demand. Being on a fractional basis is invaluable in these scenarios because I can step in and act as a dedicated in-house legal function without having a long-term commitment when this is a pretty intense, but ultimately it's a fine art process. So we were able to flex up a fractional opportunity from maybe a few hours to a week and extend and sort of increase that during the due diligence process so that I could be more boots on the ground coordinating the due diligence process, coordinating with external legal teams or with the purchasers' legal teams, identifying and mitigating risk and ensuring that all of the necessary documentation is in order. And so that just can expand to fill whatever capacity is there to guide the business through that sort of complex project. And then when that project is completed, go back to whatever it was before, a few hours a week or, you know, flex up and down as needed.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Having that continuity is so important. And the simple reality is that the financial and the legal due diligence teams on even, you know, small deals under 30 million, they can rack up from an external's perspective anywhere from 400,000 upwards each. And it's a healthy, it's an important investment in the deal, but of course it's also, it starts to become wearing after a while. So as I said, Rachel, you know, a number of my clients are looking at business combinations or exits. And those first few minutes or hours when there's the discussion around, okay, how much do you want? How much are you prepared to pay? Putting together this mythical thing called a heads of agreement as if it wasn't a contract. How do you see that playing out? Because often notional agreements or expectations get set and then you're wheeling a lawyer after the fact and then you realise that you've stuffed up royally and you have to backtrack, which never goes well for relationships or negotiation.
Yeah, I think it certainly has happened in my experience where I've been brought in and provided with a non-binding heads of agreement or term sheet to then move on with negotiating the transaction documents. And even though it is non-binding, it is very hard, as you say, John, to walk back from positions that have been agreed in that particular document. It really is anchoring the commercials of a deal in a way that is yet very hard to then try and pivot away from. And I've certainly had circumstances where there's been some things in the term sheet that have either been unclear or perhaps unwise to agree to, or they haven't been sort of commercially compensated for something in the term sheet. And it is a much more difficult uphill battle to then negotiate transaction documents, trying to find every which way to try and walk back from a certain position. I had a client where that happened and we were able to successfully negotiate something down from what was in a term sheet, but I'd say it probably added 3 months to the negotiation of the deal from what it would have otherwise been if everything had been as written on the term sheet. So it really does delay things as well.
Yeah, when you delay things, you kill the momentum which a deal needs to actually complete. And if you're winding back from what you started with, then by default, you're also saying that you're prepared to wind back from price. If not, you're just going to pay a substantial discount to the net deal proceeds on huge legal fees. So either way, it's a lose situation. In that scenario, Rachel, what have been some of the howlers that you've seen that people have put into homemade term sheets?
I think it's really just promises that the transaction agreement will have certain things in it that just haven't been factored into the price. So that might come down to very broad ranging exclusivity clauses. And it really is not commercially reflected in the price that, you know, that potential party has offered in terms of their investment or purchase or whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. So that's certainly one that springs to mind. Another one is restraints, post-completion restraints that are excessive in terms of their breadth or their length.
Yeah, I can relate to each of those, actually, as well as things around retention amounts and payment terms. Yeah, it's a fraught area. And if you don't get it right at the start, those expectations are really hard to unravel.
Yeah, that's right.
So if I'm thinking about this, how do I know when I'm ready for this approach and how to frame it up? I need to do to put it in place?
So I guess you can consider yourself ready for a fractional legal counsel if you're at the stage where you're recognizing that legal isn't just a reactive putting out fires, but it can help you and be a commercial partner to build a resilient and valuable business. So having a fractional general counsel is helpful to communicate what your business goals are. So that might be growth, investment, or an exit. Mm. And then you can identify what are the key legal areas that might impact those goals. And that helps to sort of prioritize what you want this person to actually come in and sort of help you to do. So it might be in your IP and your contracts. It might be reviewing employment obligations or overall M&A readiness. And the element that you need is to shift from reactive mindset to a proactive one and recognizing that bringing somebody in can be an investment in business's future.
Okay. So who really should be leading this? Is this a board or a CEO decision or both?
Well, I would say ultimately the CEO or a founder should be leading this, as it's ultimately a strategic sort of business decision. And you need a trusted legal partner to help execute on a particular strategy. And so this, if you bring in a fractional general counsel, they can work closely with all members of the legal leadership team, rather. So work with sales, work with your people teams and your finance teams, and ensure that legal considerations are integrated into every aspect of the business.
Mm. And so what do you see as being the gotchas when you're setting this up? What typically goes wrong that I need to look out for and avoid?
So I think one of the biggest gotchas is really underestimating the importance of early intervention. So often people will wait until a problem is critical, which is far more expensive and difficult to fix than having someone along the journey and identifying those risks earlier. Another gotcha is not clearly defining the scope of work or the list of priorities that you want your fractional legal counsel to sort of assist you with. So that might lead to sort of misunderstandings or unmet expectations. So that's ultimately about sort of having an open dialogue between the founder and the fractional counsel about, okay, when we've got business as usual work, these are your priorities. But if you have the time to work on those things that are important but not urgent, then these are the strategic priorities that sort of take precedence, and sort of understanding when you've got instructions coming from all areas of the business, just understanding what that prioritization looks like and having that visibility of what that person is actually managing for you.
Yeah. Are you looking to pinpoint the areas that will make the biggest impact on your business? Check out the Organization Performance and Value Diagnostic. This powerful tool lets you evaluate your business on multiple facets and provides email reminders to keep you on track. Head over to criticalfewactions.com.au and get started now. So, Rachel, when I set up a fractional legal counsel support mechanism, at the very start of that process, there's got to be a due diligence process from your perspective, as in what are you actually dealing with, not from a risk management perspective, but actually just understanding the lie of the land. Because we've talked about contractual, we've talked about IP, we've talked about the customer contractual relationships and so on. Chances are about 90%+ in across my client base, and I would expect across most medium businesses, that all of their legal situations have largely evolved organically and not come from a starting point of, okay, what's good or even best practice? Let's put those things in place. So is that an important part of getting started with a fractional?
Yeah, I think the main difference I find between an in-house lawyer and a fractional general counsel on the one hand and an external legal counsel on the other hand is that the in-house and the fractional, where the communication is good, hearing from the business about the issues as they're evolving almost by osmosis, by being involved in the business, by having regular check-ins with the executive or the leadership team about what's keeping them up at night, what are the things that they're working on, and having that communication lines open so that the lawyer can sort of say, hey, have you considered this? You know, from my experience working in-house, the number of times that I have literally just overheard a conversation at the lunch table about people talking about a project that they're working on and, you know, coming over and saying, I help it over here, yeah, that you were talking about this issue. Have you thought about XYZ? And it really is a good way to embed yourself with the business. And being an external counsel is, you just don't have that. It's really very reactive. Someone has to twig that there's an issue that needs to be raised, and then that person needs to be briefed. And they're usually given as much of a brief as is necessary for them to do that particular task, but no more, because they're charging in 6-minute increments. So there's not really that incentive for the founder or whoever the person is in the business who's briefing external counsel to, give a hour long, here's all the background of this, that, and the other, because it just isn't sort of the cost model for them to do that.
No.
So in the fractional model, it's certainly built into the model that part of the time is spent speaking to the stakeholders in the business about things that may not be happening now, but things that are in the pipeline that are happening in the future, and assisting with issue spotting as early as possible.
Yeah.
And that's certainly been the thing that I love most about working as an in-house person, is having that level of closeness with the business and sort of seeing things happen in real time and sort of understanding, okay, well, what happened with that client contract? Rather than being an external counsel, you might assist with something and then you never hear about it again if all goes well.
Mm.
So it often left me wondering, oh, I wonder how that turned out.
Yeah, exactly. If you really want to kick off your strategic planning and work in a supportive environment with other CEOs and leaders, the CEO Masterclass in Strategic Planning and Implementation is for you. This 10-month small group course helps you craft your strategic plan, present it to a group of peer investors, and develop a habit of monthly implementation. Our waitlist is open now at criticalfewactions.com.au. On a question then, Rachel, if a founder or a CEO is looking to start utilising a fractional legal counsel in their organisation, what critical few actions should they start tomorrow if they did nothing else?
So yeah, if you did nothing else, I'd say the first thing would be to lock down your IP early and cleanly. So have a look at your existing agreements with contractors and developers and make sure that you have clear assignments in writing of intellectual property. And if you don't have them, get them in place immediately. Your IP is often your most valuable asset, and having a clear chain of custody when it comes to ownership saves immense pain, delays, and costs, particularly if you're looking to raise capital or sell the business later.
Yeah.
And in that same vein, I guess, secondly, I'd say run your business with an eye on exit. So that means, have proper record keeping and maintenance, which sounds boring, but it is the sort of things that potential investors and buyers are going to scrutinize really carefully.
Yeah.
And having everything in order means that you're ready to take advantage of an opportunity that might arise that can help maximize the business's value.
Excellent. All right. Well, look, that really helps me understand the value of a fractional legal counsel, and certainly having someone client side as opposed to as a contracted service provider on a 6-minute time clock certainly resonates well from a value for money perspective, but more importantly, taking that proactive approach as opposed to the reactive, time-bound and urgent focus, which by default, all of those things equal expensive.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the show, John. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks for listening to the Critical Few Actions podcast. Don't forget to subscribe and grab the downloadables from the show notes. And if you found this episode helpful, I'd really appreciate it if you share it with your peers and your team. Stay focused and take action. The Critical Few Actions podcast, including show notes and links, provides general information only and is not individualized business advice, nor can it be relied upon as such. You must take responsibility for your own advice, decisions, and actions.